The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm a little surprised he's still tweeting about this stuff. It still really gets to him.
But just think for a moment how unusual it should be for a president of the United States to cavalierly and repeatedly say things that are simply not true.
And again, we have very limited answers. We have nothing to look at here. It's all fine. Don't worry about it. We got it underhand.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. TrumpCast is the show where we don't just rearrange deck chairs on the Trump-tanic. We splinter them. We get fingerprints and DNA from them and try to turn them into flotation devices. So we never end up in what they call in Get Out, the sunken place. Today we're aiming to get some confidence in our troubled times from that good old pastime of coastal elites, pedantry, and quibbling over definitions. By which I mean we're talking about either the desecration or the enlivening of the language by hot-tempered politics and even by Donald Trump himself. My guest on this topic is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, the great dictionary of American English. But first, the tweets.
No matter how much I accomplish during the ridiculous standard of the first 100 days, and it has been a lot, including Supreme Court, media will kill. The two fake news polls released yesterday, ABC and NBC, while containing some very positive info, were totally wrong in general election. Watch. Eventually, but at a later date, so we can get started early, Mexico will be paying in some form for the badly needed border wall. Don't let the fake media tell you that I have changed my position on the wall. It will get built and help stop drugs, human trafficking, etc. First, the Ninth Circuit rules against the ban, and now it hits again on sanctuary cities, both ridiculous rulings. See you in the Supreme Court.
My guest today is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster. He's going to help us make sense of our turbulent American language, the way it's changing now, and the way it's staying the same. Peter, it is so good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for asking.
I think you're our first lexicographer on TrumpCast, which brings me to what I hope will be the theme of the day, which is Caesar non supra grammaticos. Even Caesar is not above the grammarians, to which I will add lexicographers like yourself. What can dictionary life teach us about Trump? I'll begin by asking you about this uptick in interest in dictionaries. To what do you at Merriam-Webster attribute this new run on spelling and parts of speech and definitions and capsule etymology that dictionaries specialize in?
Well, you know, I think what's going on is that there is a national conversation about language more broadly that's taking place, and the dictionary has a natural place in that conversation. We have been monitoring the data from our online dictionary for 20 years now. In fact, we put it online in 1996, and the first big news event that was widely shared online was the death of Princess Diana. And that was also the first time we noticed that we could watch the news in real time through the prism of vocabulary. What I mean by that is that we had seen that the words that were looked up in our dictionary tended to be kind of SAT words. They were tough words, abstract words, words that grown-ups look up, words like ubiquitous and integrity and pragmatic and conundrum. Also words that are just tough in English, like affect and effect. But then when Princess Diana died, we saw the word paparazzi jumped to the top. And then at her funeral, the word cortège and words like that, borrowings from modern French with French pronunciations, are frequently looked up because people want to click and listen to that phonetic pronunciation. And then also the word princess itself was looked up. So we saw this interest and this curiosity that went through the Clinton impeachments and 9/11 and Michael Jackson's death and every big news event, including and especially the election. So the real story here is that the biggest subject of conversation is the current administration and politics, and that is reflected in our data. So we are seeing these words being looked up, whether they are utterances of the newsmakers or words used by the news media.
You know, there is so much quibbling, as you say, over language to do with ideology and politics on social media. Just today, I proposed that Trump has a talent for ledger demand, for distraction from the Trump-Russia affair. You know very well from past exchanges, I love pretentious language, so yeah, it's a bad habit. So one person quickly said, though, that ledger demand implies cleverness, too much cleverness to be attributed to Trump. And another went straight to the French and said it connotes, or that it literally means something to do with smaller, light hands. Mm-hmm. And so a point about politics devolved or evolved into a conversation about language and connotations and etymology.
You're right. You're exactly right. I mean, our definition of ledger demain is a display of skill or adroitness, which I think does, you know, really capture what you're talking about, you know, a skill and a capacity to do something.
Is there deception involved? I guess I think of it as a David Blaine word.
Right. So our first sense, sense number one is sleight of hand. So, but the thing is, what you're talking about is breaking ideas down to their smallest constituent parts. And that is the word. And I think what we're seeing with a lot of these trends, and two of the biggest, most looked up words in this calendar year were the word fact after the Kellyanne Conway interview where she, you know, coined the term alternative facts. And our simple sort of cut and paste tweet about that got, I think, the better part of 80,000 retweets.
Wow.
That was simply the definition of the word. Our great social media manager, Laura Natural, who has an ability to sort of project and amplify the contents of the dictionary and the articles that our staff writes for the webpage. And in that instance, all she did was sort of put the definition there, and that was itself viewed as kind of a subversive act or a corrective act. But what we were presenting was, I think, a little bit more profound and slightly more subtle, which is to say that the use of the word fact in that unusual way provoked the curiosity of many, many people in the public. And that curiosity is what we're reporting on. And that's true for every one of our TrendWatch words. And in fact, we started putting TrendWatch on our website in 2010, in May of 2010. In fact, the first word was the word austerity from the Greek debt crisis. So it's always been words in the news. And in this case, of course, again, the news happens to be the administration.
Yeah. So, like, let's take the change from fact. This is, it's always dicey business defending Kellyanne Conway. But it was not inconsistent with some of the relativism proposed by people as far afield as the deconstructionists and others who question whether there's a correspondence, whether language always stands in correspondence to measurable facts in the world. And
well, absolutely. And you know, we see from the administration and from the news that many uses of words that attract a lot of attention are uses that raise the question of meaning.
Right, of meaning itself. So give me some examples, especially Trump-oriented.
Yeah, I mean,
Trump
there's some great examples. Sure, I mean, there's some great examples. I mean, one that stands out is the use of the word betrayal, because there was Sean Spicer in a press conference, and the New York Times correspondent asked him to define betrayal, and he said, "I'm not going to define betrayal for you." And you better believe the whole country then looked up the word betrayal. In other words, the news actually raised the question of meaning in that case. And that was true also for a couple cases where, at press conferences, where Sean Spicer explained that the use by Donald Trump of the word military didn't mean military. It meant precision, according to him. And so we took a look at that, and we recognized that there is a common collocation, a common and frequently seen combination of words, military precision. But military in that case is what we would call an attributive noun, that is to say a noun modifying another noun. And it clearly gives the word precision a color, but it never means precision by itself. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's a very good reason for people to go to the dictionary and kind of check. You know, maybe he's right. Does military mean precision? Well, no, it doesn't. And there was another case where wiretap was used in a tweet. And it was clearly not meant to mean literally wiretapping, but kind of a broad sense of surveillance. And again, you know, people went to the dictionary in huge numbers, and we had a spike in that word to check on that use of language. Fact is another one, of course. When you present a term like alternative facts, you're bending the word. I mean, our definition is a piece of information presented as having objective reality. And, you know, that's something that we can sort of sit with. I mean, abstract words like fact are difficult to define, and their definitions become little nuggets of philosophy.
Right. So, I mean, I think in that case, Kellyanne Conway was talking about the crowds at the inauguration, and it clearly looked like to Trump, who through his eyes, the world generally looks quite deferential to him and enthusiastic about him. Usually when he tells accounts of the rallies from the podium or so forth, that everyone's always super enthusiastic. I mean, he's clearly had a subjective experience of the inauguration, that it was very crowded. Then they count the numbers with photographs, and it's flashed back to him that he has had a wrong impression, but he presented as fact his way of seeing things. And I don't think Kellyanne Conway was so off there.
Right, but I think the cognitive dissonance that drew people, I think, to the dictionary was this sort of confrontation between the subjective and the objective.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that will always drive people to the dictionary. In other words, one very good reason for people to look up words is to correct another person.
Yes.
You know, often that's a sibling or it's in a classroom situation, but sometimes it's in a public situation like this one.
So that seems to be one reason, pedantry or the like juicy opportunity to correct someone for a turn to the dictionary. What's another one? I mean, I see a little bit of like a fear of being left behind, or a kind of panic, even a status panic. What is a bête noire? What is l'état, c'est moi? What are some of these fancier expressions? You know, I for one had to look up immunity and impeachment, because I don't have legal books on hand, and I hoped the dictionary would lead me to the use of those words as terms of art.
Absolutely. And a term like immunity, like the word admonish, for example, which was, I believe, in raw numbers, our number one looked up word in 2009 following the Joe Wilson exchange, when Representative Wilson shouted, "You lie," to President Obama during a State of the Union speech. The term admonish was used by the Congress as his official punishment. And that's a very good example. Like immunity, both of these words, again, with classical roots, but both of these words have a kind of a general vocabulary use. But then in this instance, they suddenly seem specific and governmental and legal and technical. And whenever we see that kind of a duality, a word that has a general use, but then also a specific use that may be nested within it, boy, that's why grown-ups go to the dictionary. We don't mostly look up words that we've never seen before. We look up words for nuance and subtlety. That's what sends us to the dictionary.
Fascinating. I didn't quite realize that. And I know you all are scrupulously neutral and non-ideological at Merriam-Webster, but there is a little bit of, it's a speech act, say, for Merriam-Webster to distribute the meaning, the dictionary meaning of fact on Twitter, because you seem to close the book on the question, and it seems to say, a fact is this, and you can't mess with that. And there, that is the assertion of Caesar non supra grammaticos, that whatever Kellyanne Conway says, a fact is a fact, and we're the people who know it. The buck stops with us.
Sure. And I've got a couple things to say about that. First of all, you know, the dictionary has always called balls and strikes on spelling and meaning. So there's a traditional cultural role that we are asserting, and that existed long before I ever got this job, you know, that goes back, you know, more than 100 years. But, you know, if a public figure uses language in a remarkable way, that's fair game for us to comment on.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's true for the definition of fact or the spelling of honor or unprecedented, things like that. But, you know, just to take it out of politics to show that this is the way we do things anyway, the number two most retweeted word that was looked up in our data was the word volunteer following the United Airlines incident.
Fascinating.
And yeah, exactly. And it shows you, again, the cognitive dissonance. There was their statement, the corporate statement using the term volunteer, and yet we had seen this video in which the gentleman had manifestly not volunteered for that action. And so that drives people to the dictionary. And again, that doesn't have to be political. In that case, it was the entire culture was turned to this story for a couple of days, and our data proved it. But I don't dispute that obviously presenting it in this atmosphere today and amplifying it through Twitter, it becomes a speech act, and to a certain extent, the medium becomes the message. Twitter clearly is a medium in which we have speed and wit and irony and, you know, all of these things that are often applied to our tweets or are within our tweets, but either way, they get a lot of attention and are projected far. And we can't always control where that message lands, of course.
You know, it struck me that Hillary Clinton had this neologism in making a noun of deplorable. And she said basket of deplorables. And the people sort of most offended by that also, you know, admitted they had to look it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point. That word was an enormous spike in our data because the word itself was newsworthy, obviously. But also, you're correct, it had this functional shift. So there was a grammatical question, too.
Yeah. And also, you know, if two parties are speaking different languages, or at least two populations are speaking different languages, there's such aggression over owning the words. And it's not just, I think of it as when Donald Trump said, oh, you can't believe I said grab him by the pussy. Well, you must not understand, quote, locker room talk, another lexicon that is alien to people, or online cucks and, you know, on the other side, woke and snowflakes.
Sure. So they're sort of talking at cross purposes. And I mean, there's another example of one of these functional shifts, which was big league or bigly, depending on how people heard it. And a lot of people looked up that word bigly thinking that's not a word, you know, and it turns out, of course, that Donald Trump was using big league as in major league. But he was using it adverbially. He said they'll raise your taxes big league. And we only define it adjectivally, as in a big league candidate, for example.
Do you really, because I think this might come as news to our listeners, do you really think he didn't say bigly? How closely did you listen to the...
Yeah, well, it turns out I didn't have to listen closely. Some great linguists out at Stanford did a visual analysis of the audio file, and they recognized, because of the glottal stop or something, that he actually pronounced the G. So big league, and so he was actually saying big league, and that's the way he thinks of it. And so that got a huge amount of attention too. But I always say one thing though: we're good at reading data, we're not good at reading minds. In other words, we saw huge numbers of people looking up the word fascism, and a lot of people took that reportage as being either a kind of diagnosis or an accusation. And I would emphasize that it is neither, that curiosity is not ignorance. In fact, curiosity is kind of the opposite of ignorance. And the most important thing to remember is that, yes, fascism was among the top 20, but so was socialism and so was democracy.
Wow. Yeah, that's also fascinating. I mean, the idea that you all are collecting this kind of data, it seems extremely useful.
Well, I think it's hopeful, too, to see that we're curious, you know?
Yeah. And even if it means we want to win online, it also suggests that there's a little bit of a break on our ardor about being right. you know, let me double check before I call Trump a fascist that I really know what fascism is. So the other thing that comes to mind is this extraordinary point by Masha Gessen. I don't know if I brought this up to you before, that, you know, autocracy can, and I know you're not signing on to, you know, the idea that we're living in autocracy, but autocracy can take away our, can so perjure the language with misuses or with uses that have so much torque on them or propaganda implicit in them that we can sort of forget or get disoriented about what fundamental words mean in, you know, in our vocabulary. And as an antidote to that, you know, I think she at least has implied that Russians ought to read pre-Soviet literature, Tolstoy and so forth, so that they can understand the richness of language before, you know, before it was constrained by Soviet apparatchik language. And I think it's possible that the same thing is, you know, is going on in the U.S., that we want a robust definition of fascism that takes into account its history, its possibly its Italian roots. So it doesn't just mean asshole fascist, you know?
Right.
It doesn't, you don't want to like blunt its definition. It has such a rich history. I don't know. I mean, that makes it sound like the dictionary, especially a good dictionary, might itself be a kind of revolutionary document or a pushback.
Well, I mean, again, because we're doing our own research, we're in a kind of unique position in the media landscape. In other words, even the New York Times, if they're reporting on jobs figures, they're reporting on what, you know, some government department reported to them. Whereas we're reporting on original research, on our own research. And that gives us, again, that confidence to, you know, to call balls and strikes on meanings and also, you know, to be open to novelty and to recognize that, for example, as a lexicographer, when I heard basket of deplorables, what I heard was that innovative use of deplorable as a noun.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course we took notice of that, and maybe we someday will enter deplorable as a noun in some way. And, you know, that's the way that we analyze, you know, that we typically notice things before we judge them. In fact, doing this job for a long time, rather than making us more judgmental, which sometimes people, I think, assume is true. I've met people who say, oh, I'm afraid to make a mistake when speaking to you, which I find, you know, really kind of tragic and sad. But actually, it's sort of the opposite. We're conditioned by this job, by observing language all day, every day, to be more open and understanding and to recognize that we all express ourselves in different ways, that we recognize a standard, but we also recognize that language is in flux and that there are standards that have changed over the years. But also to your point about the ownership of meaning of a given term, I mean, it may not just be an autocrat that determines that meaning. It may also come from the atomized media landscape that we have. In other words, if we have all of these different voices, some of them reaching many, many people, maybe through Facebook, maybe through cable, maybe through radio, that those individual voices are also changing, perhaps, the way that we understand objective definitions of words, too.
You know, I will say I don't turn to the dictionary very often because it keeps me in the bubble, because I grew up with dictionaries and that's where I thought you turned for meaning. So I'm much more likely, if I'm using a word that scares me or I want to try out, like cuck, even in quotation marks, it's much more important to me to go to Urban Dictionary, to ask around, to look for uses on Twitter, because I could easily put a foot wrong with a word like cuck or woke, and then be reeling and be back on my heels. And I'm not going to win that argument by showing a page from the OED. I'm just not. do you use Urban Dictionary? Do you use some of the wikis?
Oh, sure. I mean, absolutely. Because, you know, lexicography is revision, but we're looking at language in the rearview mirror, aren't we? I mean, we're waiting for sufficient evidence and context before we can write a good definition. So that means that when a word is really, you know, innovative or new to the general public, turns out that woke has been around for a few decades, but most people have only heard of it since Black Lives Matter. So that's a term that we're watching, and we're watching cuck for sure. But we tend to wait. We're a little bit conservative on that point because we don't want to add an informal or a non-standard term that may sort of vanish from the language 3 years hence. So we do want to watch things and take a little bit of time. So we're not in an arms race in terms of getting the first definition up there. We want to see a good ample amount of evidence first.
And back to Latin, I have every confidence that Caesar's not above the grammaticos, the lexicographers. And this has been very, very illuminating, Peter. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a treat to talk to you. Thank you.
You're in the sunken place now, Virginia.
TrumpCast is produced by Jason DeLeon. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer at Panoply. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. John D. Domenico is our voice of Donald Trump. And I'm Virginia Heffernan.